First, we take our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Special Counsel Robert Mueller gave his first public remarks today since undertaking the investigation into Russian campaign interference in the 2016 election. A disaster aid package was held up in Congress by Republican opposition, and the president is pressing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to support the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, a potential replacement for NAFTA. Our question for you this week, what do you want to see out of a new North American trade deal? What's important in your line of work? Is this USMCA something you want your lawmakers to support? Do you worry about the uncertainty that trade disputes and tariffs bring about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, let's start with Robert Mueller's statement from earlier today. A big question going into this was why Mueller declined to reach a decision on whether the president obstructed justice. Here's a bit of what he had to say this morning about that investigation. Robert Mueller speaking earlier today.
Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
And Mueller also said on obstruction of justice, quoting, "If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so." So where does that leave us, Adrian?
Well, I think, you know, it's fairly clear what Mueller is saying there, where he's basically trying to, you know, let people draw their own conclusions on, you know, basically saying, you know, on one hand, we didn't feel that we could charge Donald Trump with a crime. So even if we were certain that he had obstructed justice, we wouldn't have laid a charge because, you know, we didn't think that that was constitutional. However, if we had felt that Donald Trump was innocent and we'd been able to exculpate him, we would have said so. And we've chosen not to do that. So, you know, the strong implication there is that Mueller does feel like there is evidence of a crime. And it's really up to, because he had another line, I think, in a statement where he sort of alluded to, you know, there's another process sort of outside of the criminal justice system to hold the president accountable. You know, it's clear that he's talking about impeachment or congressional action. So I think what Mueller is very much saying there is, you know, yes, we did find evidence that could point towards obstruction of justice. I didn't feel comfortable making a determination. I didn't feel comfortable making a determination of whether that did, you know, constitute obstruction of justice because, you know, you can't do that with a president. So it's essentially up to Congress to decide. And so I think that's really, you know, sort of maybe the big message from Mueller today is that, I've found the evidence. You know, there's clearly something there, but I'm sort of going to leave it to Congress to make a determination on whether they think that's impeachable or not.
And we've been hearing responses in NPR News from members of Congress. What has been the tone of the reaction from both parties?
I mean, you've basically heard from the Republicans repeated the line that the White House has had from the beginning on Mueller, basically saying, you know, Mueller didn't make a determination. He doesn't come out and say that the president obstructed justice. He didn't find any evidence of collusion between, or any proof of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. So, you know, case closed. Let's move on with our lives. You know, that's sort of the message from the Republicans in the White House. What Democrats are essentially saying, and particularly the Democratic presidential contenders, is, Mueller has referred this to Congress, and it's up to Congress to make a decision. And the decision we think Congress should make is to commence impeachment proceedings. So, you know, we sort of got those two. In some ways, the kind of macro line from each party is maybe not surprising. I think what's more interesting in some ways is kind of what's happening within the Democratic Party and the fact that you've got, you know, some members, and particularly the, Kamala Harris and some of the other presidential contenders saying, you know, we should be moving forward with impeachment. But the leadership of the Democratic Party in Congress, and particularly Nancy Pelosi, you know, is sort of the one who will ultimately make the decision on whether they push forward with this, is basically saying, you know, kind of, you know, it is a bit more mooted, you know, it has kind of said in the past, you know, kind of cool your jets, you know, impeachment isn't really the thing we should be focusing on. So I think there's kind of a tension within the Democrats there, where on one hand, you know, some of them will say, you know, it's very clear sort of what Mueller is. Mueller's given us this responsibility. We think there's evidence in the report that points to an impeachable offense. But then on the other hand, you know, Pelosi, I think, is playing a kind of tactical game and feels that, you know, voters in general in America don't care that much about impeachment compared to, you know, health care and other sort of pocketbook issues. And she would rather, you know, the Democrats kind of focused on that ahead of 2020 rather than, you know, getting bogged down basically in impeachment proceedings.
I want to bring on a caller on this. Dennis is with us in Manitowoc County. Dennis, hi.
I was just wondering, if Robert Mueller is called to testify, would Mueller be allowed to reveal anything that's been redacted, or is it just what's been redacted is not going to be available through any source?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Adrian, yeah, there's a fair amount of the Mueller report, even though it's publicly available, that's blacked out. Do we know if that would be any different if you were testifying before Congress?
I think, yeah. So my understanding is I think Mueller could technically reveal at least some of the things that he's blacked out. I think he might actually have the ability to do that. But I think from what he said today, the indication would be quite strongly that he probably wouldn't do that, or that he would try to find kind of a way around it and say, you know, I agree with the, William Barr's assessment or the national security folks' assessment that, you know, these sort of matters go to sources and methods or go to national security, so I shouldn't say anything on them. Or, you know, or that these are, you know, part of sort of an ongoing criminal investigation. I don't really want to get into that to sort of jeopardize, you know, someone else's investigation. So, I think Mueller maybe technically could reveal at least some of the redacted information in testimony. But I think my strong sense today from what he was saying is that he probably wouldn't go any further than what's already been released publicly if he were to testify.
Talking to Adrian Morrow from the Globe and Mail about some of the top stories in national politics. And Adrian, before we move on to what Robert Mueller had to say, he really suggested that, hey, if you bring me before Congress, I'm just going to say stuff that's already in the report. You should just read the report. It's all there. But there's been a question of, hey, maybe he's trying to tell us, go to the words of the report, not the summaries given by anybody else, whether that's Attorney General Barr or members of either party. He thinks what he has to say is already on paper.
Yeah, I think it's telling that he did choose to highlight certain elements of the report today, you know, basically coming out and saying, you know, I didn't indict Trump because I don't think you can indict a sitting president. If I had found that he hadn't committed a crime, I would have said so. I didn't say so. You know, so I mean, I think there is some, you know, you can sort of draw some inferences from the things he's hinting at. So, you know, it's true that he explicitly said he wasn't going to go beyond the report in any future, you know, today or at any sort of future date. But I think it is telling that he chose to highlight certain aspects of the report that, you know, clearly he felt people should be paying attention to.
I want to move on to trade now. Adrian, we've talked to you in the past about negotiations between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to replace NAFTA with this U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. A lot of people may think, wait, isn't this done? We had a deal, but it's not done, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there is a deal between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, but it still has to be ratified by the legislatures of all three countries. So it has to be ratified by the U.S. Congress, the Mexican Congress, and the Canadian Parliament before it takes effect. So on the Canada and Mexico side, it's actually not really a problem because in both Canada and Mexico, the respective leaders, Justin Trudeau and Lopez Obrador, control, you know, hefty majorities of their respective legislatures, and they can sort of get the deal passed fairly easily. The U.S. is really sort of the issue because the Democrats control the lower house of Congress, and so there's this negotiation going on essentially right now between the administration and the Democrats to try to get enough support to pass the deal.
A couple of hurdles here. Now, outside this deal, we had these steel and aluminum tariffs on Canadian and Mexican imports. Those are going away now. What happened?
Yeah, so there was essentially, you know, Trump had put those tariffs on Canada and Mexico, during the NAFTA negotiations. And initially he said that the purpose of the tariffs was to get Canada and Mexico to make a deal, to put a little bit of added pressure. But even after they made a deal on the USMCA, he kept the tariffs on. And so there was this whole sort of, months long, you know, essential back and forth. And basically what Trump wanted was for Canada and Mexico to agree to quotas, to say, we won't send any more than a fixed percentage, a fixed amount of steel and aluminum to the U.S. every year. Canada and Mexico said, no, we're not going to agree to quotas. Finally, the U.S. A couple of weeks ago sort of buckled. They basically said, you know, essentially what Canada and Mexico agreed to do instead was they said, we'll help you, you know, because we know that your real concern on steel is steel coming from China. And so we'll help you crack down on the possibility of steel being sent, you know, from China, routed through Canada and Mexico as sort of a backdoor into the U.S. market. We'll help you crack down on that if in exchange you lift the tariffs. And that was sort of ended up being enough for, you know, for the Trump administration, that they sort of dropped their demand for quotas and made a deal. I think that what was really going on there, and the reason why the U.S. agreed to a deal, was that they knew that, you know, and Canada and Mexico had told them, you know, we're not going to ratify USMCA until you lift those tariffs. And so, you know, the U.S., I think at a certain point decided, you know, this is this is sort of the price we pay. You know, we'll give up on our dream of having quotas on steel and aluminum, you know, basically in exchange for, Canada and Mexico being sort of willing to move forward and do ratification. So that's really sort of the, I guess, the quid pro quo there.
Do we continue our conversation with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for The Globe and Mail, looking at the week's top political news. Adrian, we were talking about this NAFTA replacement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. As you said, the big sticking point now is a ratification by the American Congress. So what are the stumbling blocks there?
So the main thing that the Democrats have basically demanded is that they want tougher labor standards written into the deal, and particularly on the Mexican side, because Mexico has a history of poor labor conditions. Not only is it bad for Mexican workers, but that's sort of the argument that a lot of people in the particularly in the Midwest and another sort of the manufacturing sector in the U.S. have made, is that those sort of poor labor conditions in Mexico allow Mexico to attract jobs basically that might otherwise go to the U.S. Down to Mexico, companies sort of going for people that for workers who will work for less and accept sort of poorer working conditions than Americans or Canadians would. So that's sort of that's the kind of the main demand. And then there's a few other they'd like some more environmental regulations written into NAFTA. The Democrats would. They've also asked for some of the stuff on pharmaceutical patents to kind of be dialed back. Pharmaceutical patent protections to be dialed back in an effort to lower prescription drug prices. And they've asked for sort of a stronger language on enforceability of the deal and sort of the ability of the U.S. again to particularly hold Mexico accountable, if they breach any terms of the deal. So the Democrats have kind of made a lot of those high level demands to the Trump administration, but it's not clear that they've really sort of boiled it down to a handful of specific things or said, okay, here's a specific measure that we want you to sort of write into the implementing legislation on USMCA in order to support it. So I think that's sort of where they're at now. That there's this back and forth between Pelosi and Robert Lighthizer, is the main the U.S. trade representative, to try to sort of negotiate that and figure out, well, what is it that the Trump administration can do that would sort of satisfy the Democrats' demands?
I want to bring in a couple callers on this now. Carol is with us in Stevens Point. Carol, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Carol?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment that the unknown tariffs from goods made in China seem to be a real issue with my business. I opened a business about 5 years ago importing women's fashion accessories from Spain, and some are made in China. The vegan line is made in China. I sell wholesale only, and the issue is we've already started selling. We sell 6 months ahead of time. We've already started selling our goods for winter, and we have some more orders coming in, obviously, from shows in June and August. But I have no idea whether I'm even going to make a profit this year because the prices are already set. The purchase orders are in. We have to sell them for what we promised to sell them for, and the customs and tariffs could go up to the point where it puts us out of business.
Carol, thanks for that call. Adrian, stand by for a moment. I want to bring on Richard now in Rice Lake. Richard, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story, Richard?
Well, I've been working in the auto parts industry for about 3 years now, and especially in the past year, obviously, since the tariffs have taken effect, I've noticed an increase in auto parts, brake calipers, rotors, things that require certain steels, certain metals, and paints, more especially because of dyes and chemicals.
And part because of the tariffs, you think, Richard?
Oh, most definitely. This has been discussed with me and higher management.
Thanks a lot for that call, Richard. So there we're hearing, Adrian, two of the big concerns about tariffs: rising costs for businesses and consumers in the U.S., and then, Carol, unpredictability for businesses, not knowing what the tariff is going to be in 6 months or whether they're going to make money or not as a result.
Yeah, I mean that's been sort of the difficulty for in Trump's trade war is that he sort of has this notion that that putting tariffs on people either force them to kind of come to the table and negotiate a better deal with the U.S. Or that it will sort of protect the industries that he really likes, and the steel industry is a great example of that. But I think what he often fails to take into account is exactly that. You've got small businesses and in some cases larger businesses, in the auto parts sector, that depend on having access to either these imported goods or imported raw materials. And I think that the steel tariffs are sort of a good example of that, where there's something like 10 times the number of jobs in industries that use steel as part of their production process as there are in the actual steel industry. So, yeah, the president's tariffs maybe sort of protecting or helping, the U.S. steel industry itself. But there are all these other people like Richard who work in these, these other industries that need steel and aluminum and often will import it across the border from Canada, as part of their production process. They basically see higher costs because of the tariffs. So, so once the sort of, there may be some strategy behind it on Trump's part in terms of trying to sort of, push people into making other countries into making trade deals by inflicting some, some temporary economic pain. But the real risk for him is that he ends up inflicting more economic pain on his own country than he does on anybody else.
Carol and Richard, thanks for your calls. We're talking to Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Before we move on from trade, Adrian, back and forth with China going on, too, amidst all of this talk of the USMCA. What are you watching for on that side of the trade story?
Yeah, I mean, China's an interesting case in the sense that, unlike Canada and Mexico, which, it's sort of debatable whether Canada and Mexico really were sort of bad trade actors. Nobody really disputes that China has done and is doing a lot of things that are, that are nefarious on the international stage and that would be sort of against the rules of international norms on trade. Most of the debate there, I think, is over Trump's tactic and this notion that, instead of sort of trying to build a coalition of democratic countries or free market economies to challenge China at the WTO or another sort of international fora, he's chosen the sort of unilateral route and really hasn't. And at the same time, has sort of gone after, has fought these trade battles with American allies like Canada and Mexico and the European Union, and instead sort of gone this kind of unilateral route in imposing tariffs on China. And so I think there's also a real question of to what extent Trump really is using these tariffs to try to pressure China into a good deal, versus how much Trump himself believes erroneously that tariffs are good economic policy and likes having these tariffs in place on China because he thinks that it's a good way to encourage American manufacturing, or that somehow it's going to bring jobs back from China into the U.S. I think that in some ways is really worrisome, because it's the first one. If he really is just trying to pressure China into a deal, there is a certain rationale for that. But if it's the second, and Trump really just thinks that tariffs are good economic policy in and of themselves, I think that'd be very worrying for American workers, because the longer these tariffs are on, the more economic pain there is.
More coming up on trade with U.S. Congressman Ron Kind in just a few minutes. Want to turn to a disaster aid package in Congress. $19 billion for places affected by wildfires, flooding, and hurricanes. Looked like it was about to happen, then it didn't happen. What happened?
Yeah, so they've been trying since last year to pass this relief package for some southern states and some western states hit by hurricanes and wildfires. And initially, the holdup for months was the fact that that Trump basically wanted border wall funding written into this funding package. The Democrats resisted and kind of fought him on it. And they eventually came to a sort of compromise where they put some funding for the border into the package, but with some rules around how you could spend it to try to discourage it from being diverted to build the border wall. So Trump is on board. Republican leadership is on board. But these individual Republican members of the House there have been two of them now who have blocked successive attempts to pass this legislation. And part of the reason they said that they've done it is for the border wall issue, that they feel that the Democrats that the Republicans shouldn't have compromised on that with the Democrats, and that the Democrats should allow funding in this aid package to be used to build a border wall. But then the other part of it is this kind of process argument where these two Republican members of the House have basically said that they disagree with, on principle, with spending this much money in a relatively using a sort of a fast track process to kind of get it through, and that they think there should be a lengthier debate, I guess, about the money being spent.
Right. This was trying to get unanimous approval while the House is on recess. Is it likely that this is going to pass when everybody gets back and they can have an old fashioned vote on it?
Yeah, I mean, it will. Like, it certainly will pass if there's, over time. It's really just as long as there's sort of an ability for one or two people to hold it up because of the unanimous consent issue, or when they need unanimous consent. That's when you sort of get people obstructing it. But it will, it will pass if they can get it. Eventually, if they can get it there. At this point, it's just kind of a timing issue in terms of sort of when it gets through. When it gets to President Trump to be signed into law, and how fast the aid money is able to flow.
In our last few moments, President Trump was in Japan. He criticized Democratic presidential candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden. Without getting too much into the details, is this a hint that President Trump views Joe Biden as his most likely opponent?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Trump also sees, he looks at someone like Joe Biden, and he sees somebody who can kind of win over the sort of voters that I think Trump really keys in on, the sort of working class white, former Democratic voters in the Rust Belt, but that's sort of who he sees as having helped, kind of been the difference maker in the last election. And I think he looks at Joe Biden and he sees Biden as the most likely person to be able to sort of win those voters back. So I think that's why he's particularly fixated on Biden. And at the same time, Biden's a front runner. I mean, he's clearly sort of had the largest advantage in the polls, since before he even declared for president. And so I think that's why Trump is sort of most worried about him. He does sort of see this guy as as a popular person who could defeat him. And so I think that's why Trump never sort of plays for subtlety. He never sort of holds anything back. And so I think we can take it at face value that the fact he's tweeting about Joe Biden so much tells you that he's worried about him.
Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail in Canada. No tariffs applied to his appearance, to my knowledge. He was with us for a weekly check-in in the top stories in national politics.